Hello and welcome back to Big Mouth, where every week we launch a petition demanding that your favourite band's disappointing last album be remade with new, more competent musicians. I'm Andrew Harrison, sitting here with a clipboard full of grievances, but don't worry listeners, Sean Pattenden is here too with a positive view on life and all it affords. Hello Sean, how are you doing?
I'm alright, thanks Andrew Harrison.
Are you remotely bothered about having Game of Thrones rewritten to your own personal specific preferences?
No, I thought that's what fan fiction was for.
Yeah.
They have that on the net, that's where you rewrite what your stuff. You don't tell the organisers, the producers, the everybody that you're really upset with the way it's gone. I think that's terrible.
I live in fear that actually all fiction is going to turn into fan fiction at some point.
Maybe we're in it now.
Absolutely, yes. How did your live draw of the Eurovision Song Contest go?
It went marvellously, thank
you. Just explain to the listeners briefly what it was.
I will. Every year, I've done this for 6 years running because I'm a fool. I live draw all the acts of the Eurovision Song Contest and people donate and the money goes to Great Ormond Street. And this year, we raised £645.
That's a 50% increase on last year as well.
Absolutely. Very well spotted. Maths genius there. Yeah, it was really, really good fun. It's terrifying because what you're doing is essentially doing a watercolour in 2 minutes and it can go horribly wrong, but there's only one. I mean, you know, you make a mistake. But it gets cheered on by people on Twitter and it becomes this sort of big community thing. And it was joyous.
Did you, because I didn't actually see it, but was it Iceland who turned up in a kind of series of gimp outfits? That
Absolutely.
Looked quite complicated. To do.
Iceland were wonderful. Yes, the detail on that, I think I missed a little bit of detail, but for the overall feel, which was a lot of fire. So we got a lot of fire on that one. Yeah, some people's costumes are incredibly intricate. It's very difficult to do. Some people are actually quite boring. So you just draw them in a corner, you draw the left-hand side, you just draw their feet or something like that. So it's quite varied. They've all gone out, all the competition winners as such. People will be getting their paintings at the end of the week.
Was Madonna any good? I missed the whole thing.
I thought it was wonderful, but by that point I couldn't really see because I've been drawing for 2.5 hours solid, and a goat could have walked on and sort of shat and I would have been very, very happy. Not to say that she was like that. I thought she was brilliant. She wasn't singing in tune, but I don't really care about those sorts of things.
Since when did we care about singing in tune?
Exactly.
Yes, we had to cancel the entire show.
And she did a bit. Obviously, it's controversial. It's Israel. She did a bit of Palestine, Israel together, you know.
Yeah,
she had a go.
Let's meet the first of our guests. Michael Hann writes about music for The Guardian, The FT, The Spectator, Uncut, Classic Rock, Prog, Pitchfork, The Quietus, Modern Potato Farming, The Meat Trades Journal and The Sacramento Bee. He was once the music editor of The Guardian, but now he gets to pick and choose the plum jobs for himself. So this week he went to see Sting and Shaggy. Hello, Michael, how are you doing?
I'm all right.
How was the Sting and Shaggy experience?
It was very peculiar.
Was it?
Got to say, very peculiar. I found myself thinking, all those years ago, when Sting made his quest for gravitas and started making jazz albums and lute albums and albums of madrigals, did he ever imagine that the day would come when he'd be taking the role of Shaggy's sidekick, Ravon, while playing a Steve Miller Band bass line as Shaggy performed Angel?
I don't think he did he? Do you think this is Sting's midlife crisis? Why do I just stop trying to save the world via the madrigal and the lute and just, like, brock out with Shaggy?
The other thing that I think was unintentional bathos was Shaggy told us all that we were, you know, all the same under the skin, you know, we could come together no matter what we were, whether we were black or white. And they interpolated Message in the Bottle with a bit of Get Up, Stand Up. And all along I was thinking, do you know, not one of the people here is going to have to worry about their rights on the way home. None of these people are going to be arrested. And we're not all just the same under the skin. We're actually all the same on the skin in this audience. I think I saw one black person who wasn't on the stage in the crowd. There may have been more. I mean, I don't know, but it felt very odd.
Did any point was Shaggy shout, Shaggy! As he does on his own record.
Constantly, through all of them. And also, he got some verses on Englishman in New York, in which he became a Jamaican in New York, walking down the street with a great big spliff, I'm a Jamaican in New York.
I think he did that. He actually did that on record once. He actually did, or somebody did, because as you know, the world of reggae is very fast and loose. When it comes to copyright, just do your own version, not pay. Somebody, possibly Shaggy, actually did that. So, you know.
Shaggy inserted himself into more or less everything, including Every Breath You Take, you know, which certainly benefits from some chat in between lines.
So this is Shaggy's fan fiction, isn't it? Really, he is Shaggy for his own ends. Shaggy.
I also went to see Primal Scream.
Oh,
but
they could use a bit of Shaggy.
I was hoping very much for some Bobby Gillespie political observations from the stage, but sadly there weren't any. There was quite a lot of raised fists in the air in solidarity with the white middle-aged men who are campaigning against social injustice.
Now, did you notice that Uncut, which you write for, and also The Remains of the NME, have been sold to BandLab Technologies, a Singapore-based music software business? Apparently, these two media brands will play an enormous role in continuing our vision to create a connected world of music.
Well, they've bought up quite a few music magazines in Britain already. I think some of these specialist titles, you know, the ones dedicated to people who play particular instruments.
Like Xylophone World, that kind of thing.
Kazoo Player, you know, that kind of thing. So I think at least they're people who are interested in music, unlike you know, the former owners who clearly had absolutely no interest in music whatsoever.
I like the idea that they're going to create a connected world of music. I thought there already was. The major problem that it's a connected world of music and nobody's paying for the bloody stuff. Isn't that the issue? Anyway, Sean, who else is on the show?
Anthony Teasdale is either the world's most Balearic scouser or the world's scousiest Balearic DJ. He's written for countless music and style magazines, DJs with soothing Mediterranean beats in an upscale bar near you, and now edits the gentleman's magazine Umbrella. Welcome back to Big Mouth Tony T.
Big up all man dem.
How are you?
Yeah, really great. I've had a lovely morning walking around, because we're in a new studio today, aren't we? In West London.
Yes.
And this is, I remarked on this to Sean when I came in, that West London in weather like this looks like Madrid. It's full of excellent people drinking coffee, and it's loads more hip than East London at the moment.
Were you tempted to run to a turntable and just start?
I just wanted to come and thought, hang on a minute, I've got a copy of Chris Rea's Josephine, the dub here. I'll just play this.
The Balearic Beach Bar.
Yeah, you know, as another National Express coach goes by to Torquay, I thought, I could drop Hoomba Hoomba Voice of Africa here. Yeah. Everything will just chill out.
Or La Passionara or something like
that. Yeah, yeah. So everything is good in my world at the moment. That's really interesting. Editing pretentious magazines, really. Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Have you got over Liverpool not winning the Premier League yet?
I got over it on the morning after Company hit that wonder goal.
Yeah.
So I was watching it with my wife, and he got the ball, and I thought, go on, hit it, were my words. Mm. He listened to me, took my advice.
So it's your fault.
It's my fault. Yeah, but I am very excited about Madrid, and obviously I won't be going.
It looks like Baker Street now. It looks like
I mean, I can stay here. Which, one of those things, which is like the idea of going sounds great, but the reality, it's better to watch it on the telly.
Expensive,
like in everything really.
Right,
everything is better on the telly.
Why is there no football record for your team in the Champions League final?
Well, they kind of died about 10, 15 years ago. I think the last major one, but that wasn't in England. Was Glasgow Rangers did one for when they won their 455th Scottish League title or something.
Was it called, not this again?
But I just think everyone kind of realised they were incredibly naff. I think the last one I can remember for an English Cup team would have been the Millwall FA Cup record.
Wow.
But they
still, like screwdriver or something.
Football records still get made, but they're commemorative records now made for tournaments by major pop stars. The team record has finally gone. But yeah. I will say at this point, drawing attention away from Liverpool and towards QPR.
Which is what the listeners want.
The single greatest football record ever is by the Loftus Roadrunners, released in 1977, written by Bruce Thomas of The Attractions, and it's a glam rock stomper. QPR are the only team to have an authentic glam rock stomper recorded for them.
Well, I'm still standing up for the Anfield Rap, produced by the late, great Derek B.
Derek B.
He was great. Liverpool FC is hard as hell, yes. I'm glad I got you both there, because you're both politically engaged here. It's been a really great week for Legends of Heritage Rock, with Morrissey wearing a badge from the far-right For Britain party, Bobby Gillespie coming out with a load of adolescent nonsense about Israel and Madonna over Eurovision, and then Andy Partridge from XTC, like, I'm having to clear all my record shelves now, having this shameful meltdown about Holocaust revisionism. What is it about these guys of a certain age that they go down this rabbit hole of conspiracism and genuinely nasty politics?
Thankfully, this goes out after my review of Primal Scream appears, because that is actually the opening paragraph.
Right. What is it about these guys?
Well, Bobby Gillespie is no surprise, is that? I mean, bear in mind that at Glastonbury, what was it, 10, 15 years ago, when invited to sign a Make Poverty History banner, he wrote Make Israel History instead.
Yeah, thereby ruining it and making the signing by all the other stars completely pointless.
It's all about Bobby. Mm. And also forgetting that if you make Israel history, you kind of, I mean, that's actually the foreign policy of all the nations surrounding Israel. That's not actually liberating Palestine in any meaningful way. That's just more genocide.
Yeah.
Why do we listen to pop stars and politics?
Well, that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah. You know, I don't go to sort of, you know, a councillor on the Wirral and ask him to play, you know, Stairway to Heaven, do I? So that's the sort of level we're at. I think people get very used to, these stars get very used to being listened to, and people take, you know, what they say seriously, but they are entertainers. They are travelling minstrels.
True, but it does pull, you know, I can no longer listen to Morrissey. I spent too long defending him, going, oh, you know, separate the art from the artist. But when he's prancing around right now, overtly, as part of a live show with a For Britain badge on, just think, get out of my ears and get out of my life.
I think there is a place for it. I mean, I think it's less important when it's middle-aged rock stars basically talking to middle-aged fans who actually know what they think anyway, and either go, oh, get lost, or, yay, Morrissey. And there are people who do that. But it can still have an impact. I mean, so earlier this week, after the Alabama abortion law passed, 1975 were playing in Alabama, and Matty Healy made a speech from the stage about how appalling this was and how men didn't have the right to control women's bodies. And that's actually a really powerful thing to do, given that their audience is teenage girls. He is saying to them, you don't have to stand for that. So when you're talking to people who are still trying to work out what they think, I mean, well, hopefully, if the pop star's saying the right thing, then I think there is a point in it. There is something positive from it. I mean, come on, when we were all teenagers, we'd read The Enemy, and of course, sometimes we're going, oh, you're talking rubbish, mate. But other times, you'd be inspired to go and look for things because you'd read about them.
Who is this Nelson Mandela? We should get him out of jail.
I did buy the 7-inch of I'm Not Gonna Play Sun City, which I played on our Ferguson, what are they called? Music Centre.
Yes. There you go.
You know, well, so
the flowering of your political consciousness.
That was like, come on, fist.
And he's never played Sun City since.
It's a good record.
It's a good record, yeah.
Right, let's keep it light, or maybe not. This week we're going to be talking about Antipodean punk toe rags Amyl and the Sniffers, whose debut album is out next week. Exactly how bargain basement is this punk thing, and will you, the listener, like them? Also, The Virtues on Channel 4, the new four-part Shane Meadow series featuring the great Stephen Graham as an ordinary bloke wrestling with repressed memories and family breakdown. Come back. It's great. What's going on in The Virtues, and where does it fit into the Shane Meadows pantheon? And the new album by multidisciplinary LA hip-hop electronica space jazz person Flying Lotus. What is Flamagra? Is it Flamagra?
Flamagra, I don't know.
Flamagra.
Sounds like one of those pills they sell on the internet.
What is it all about anyway, and where will it fit into your personal universe? But first, Andrew.
A quick reminder to Manchester veterans and Austere Factory Records devotees of the Greater London Area and Northern Rail Corridor. I'm playing a full night of New Order at a high-end audio bar Spiritland in King's Cross on Thursday the 6th of June as part of their Spiritland Legend series. Anthony Teasdale, you will attest to this. Spiritland's has a sound system to die for. Even the toilets sound better than the speakers in your house. And the Spiritland's Legend series has saluted everybody from Prince to the Beatles to Diana Ross. I'm going to be playing New Order's best album tracks, rarities, remixes and anything else that sounds good. At least three versions of two Tutti Frutti are guaranteed, and the cocktails, booze and food are pretty good as well. It's all happening from 8pm till 1am at Spiritland, Granary Square, King's Cross on Thursday the 6th of June. And remember, you can get every edition of Big Mouth a day early if you support us on the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Sign up for the price of a pint, a mere £5, and we'll send you the show as soon as it's ready. And you'll get the extra bit too, exclusive to our Patreon backers. This week, Anthony and Michael are going to give their suggestions of the albums that ought to be force-fed to children at an impressionable age, and the ones that ought to be removed from history and never spoken of again. Search Patreon Big Mouth to find out more. All we're saying is buy us a pint. Okay, let's start with Poppers O'Clock. Amyl and the Sniffers are a spectacularly seedy punk band from Melbourne. They've got mullets, and they actually look like they smell quite bad. Their stuff is cheap, nasty, riffy and stupid. The singer really is called Amyl, or rather Amy Taylor, so it's not a which one's Dexy's scenario, and they're having a lot of fun. Their self-titled debut album absolutely pongs with stale ale and bonus points. It's all 29 minutes long. Is it any good? We're going to find out after this track. This is Got You. Amyl and the Sniffers, Michael Howe, this is the periodic resurgence of Remember When Punk Rock Was Supposed to Be Stupid and Fun, isn't it? You're quite an admirer, aren't you?
Of punk rock or of Amyl and the Sniffers?
Amyl and the Sniffers.
I think you had me pegged slightly wrongly,
Andrew. Really? Did you not like this? I thought it was right up your street.
It's not that I think it's bad, but groups like this, I think, stand or fall on what they do live. That's what it's all about. Now, I saw Amyl and the Sniffers when they first came over to the UK about this time last year. And they were incendiary. Amy Taylor is an extraordinarily charismatic front woman. And with her in front of you, you kind of get the whole thing, which is sort of Dolly Parton fronting Sham 69. And those
I'm sold now, yeah.
And those couple of EPs that they did were kind of great fun. They were rickety and cheap and sharp, and that's what this should be. But the album, I'm kind of less convinced by. I'm not sure the production does it any favours. It's produced by Ross Orton, who is kind of the the jackbooted 48 tracks of guitars person who's worked on Arctic Monkeys and Vaccines and people like that. And to me, the record sounds like a headache. There's just too much of it. It's too pummeling. It's like being smashed around the head repeatedly, which can be a good thing. But in this case, I'm not sure entirely is. Now, I don't think that would matter if they had amazing riff after amazing riff after amazing riff, but they don't. They have pretty good riffs. The kind of thing that when you're watching them in a club, go, yeah, this is fantastic fun. But on a record, you think there needs to be more. Now, none of this would be an issue, really, if they hadn't had the incredible levels of hype around them, with people saying, this is the most exciting band in generations. If people just said, this is good little Australian garage band, then you'd go, yes, it really is. But when you're being told this is the future of rock and roll, you react by going, no, actually, it's not. And I think the hype says more about the shortage of really good rock and roll bands at the moment than it does about the Merritts of Hamlin and the Sniffers. Now, don't get me wrong, they are not a bad group. I really don't want to sound like I'm slagging them off, because I think they're great fun. But they're just not as good as people want them to be, which is a different thing. I do think there's also, in the coverage of them, a slight element of the kind of fetishization of the working class, because I've interviewed them as well. I did a piece about kind of Australian yob rock last year, which is a kind of music I do really like, genuinely. But Hamlin and the Sniffers are authentically not university students pretending to be tough kids. They are tough kids.
Actual tough kids,
And some of the coverage, it reminds me a bit of when Happy Mondays first came out. Yeah. And, you know, middle-class journalists go, oh, you're so
dirty! They're so real! They're actually poor! It's amazing!
Yeah, which I find kind of unpleasant, I've got to say.
So it's a qualified 3.5 or something like that?
Yeah, for me, I reviewed it for The Guardian and I gave it 3. And, I mean, obviously, reviews editors like you to not give 3. But I said, look, this is genuinely a 3. I mean, that's what it is. It's a pretty good record.
Tony Tay, I'm guessing this is probably not your cup of tea.
No, I thought she sounded a bit like Susie Quattro.
And what's wrong with that?
that would be great.
Yeah, I understand what's wrong with that.
But you know, taking that on board, I quite enjoyed it. I enjoyed it more than I thought I would. I mean, there was like a relief when every song ended.
Half of them are under 2 minutes.
Because it is like being hit around the head with a lot of mid-range sound. But there was a couple of tracks on there that I actually liked. There was one called Gacked on Anger, which is the sort of thing I'd call it if I was 13.
Yes, yes.
And I'd feel very rebellious. And I did quite enjoy that. But if you like punk music, you might like this. I think Michael is right here. But it does show that this is a form of music that hasn't moved on in 40 years.
Yeah. But then, I mean, that's sort of so much wrapped up in the idea of what's authentic and what's for real, man. What I liked about it was that it was fun and it wasn't just another bunch of, you know, umpteenth generation Clash knockoffs telling you how serious they are and what a serious world we live in, and think about it. Yeah, this is just like jump up and down, splash the beer all over the place. The tunes are, they might not be weapons grade, you know, internationally memorable, but they do the job for 2 minutes and 28 seconds. And it's very much not my cup of tea, but I did find myself enjoying it, like you, an awful lot more than I thought I was going to. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, idiot chanting on the go and sort of, you know, and the Aussie accent is right to the fore.
Yes, I like that.
And it's a little bit different. Yeah, I just thought it was nice to have something that's not a bunch of, you know, quite dedicated young people wanting to be actually, you know, a really good singer and a really good writer. And ultimately the goal is to be Gary Barlow. I'm glad that they don't want to be Gary Barlow.
I think, you know, if they made loads of money, she'd unashamedly have a massive house with the swimming pool. And I think that'd be a really great thing.
It would.
I find very interesting. There used to be, I think, a scene in Melbourne what they call scalpers. Do you know about them?
Sharpies. Yes, there's an article that's got about the Sharpies
and
in it.
When I looked at them, they sort of had short hair with like little mullet, and I thought, there's something here. And yes, if you don't like that sort of music, and I basically don't, it's pretty good for
If you don't
that.
Like it, you'll like this.
Yeah, I would say give it a go on Spotify. There are a couple of banging tracks on there, and I will give them a bit of full respect for that. Yeah.
Apologies to producer Elsie, who's from Australia, for our Australian splaining there, as we pretend to know what we're on about. Sian, what did you think of it?
Well, again, I've seen them live last year at the Windmill Brixton, which is a tiny venue, and it was sold out, and that's really... What you should do is you should see Amel and the Sniffers. They are, we haven't used the phrase singles band. They're a singles band. It's fine. The album's fine. But again, it was like I was on track 8 or something. I was thinking, is this going to stop? I'm thinking, oh, it's only 25 minutes in. Yeah. It's just samey and bless them. And it's very trebly and it's not very well produced. And I think that was the point. But you've got to see them live. You've got to see her. She crowd surfs everywhere. They are incredible. And that's where they really exist. And I did think... Rough Trade signed them at the end of last year. What's the point of putting out an album? Do people put out an album? I don't know what the point is.
What you say now is, what's the point of putting out singles, wouldn't you? Because, I mean, actually, what's the point of putting out records at all?
Well, yes, but, you know, there are singles, but put out some EPs, make it, give it that kind of momentum, because I think this falls very, very flat sonically and just... I feel bad saying it.
I just wanted to ask you about
flat.
What was the crowd like when you went to see them in terms of age, etc.?
Oh, wonderfully, it ranged from 16 up. To all the people, you know, sort of stroking their chins like me at the back. Well, actually, I was trying to pogo. But there were really, really young people there really getting into it. She's got lots of female fans as well, which is really great to see. She is, quote unquote, empowering, but in that fantastic way. I just think she's wonderful. And this just doesn't do them justice. I just think the album's the wrong format, man.
What would Smash Hits have done with them?
Oh, you said this about Sleaford Mods. And she also said she really likes Sleaford Mods. And I see there's a thread.
Yeah.
Sleaford Mods thread. There's that. This is what we do. They would have given them the biscuit tin. They would have given them the cover. They would have taken them somewhere where the zoo, fun fair, something like that. Had a day out with Amel and the Sniffers. Got really drunk in the afternoon. Smash Hits always did that.
It would be some kind of a headline along the lines with Cod Australian in the headline. It would have been like, Struth, it's Amel from out of Amel and the Sniffers. And they would have put in a corky hat or something, wouldn't they?
Yes, absolutely. Probably. But yeah, nothing wrong with that. Pineapple on the head. Okay.
From this, I got the kind of vibe of like, this is the kind of band where, yes, I am going to go and see them at Glastonbury. And then after one song, I have to go and have a 2-hour lie down in the tiny tea tent. But I probably will go and see them at Glastonbury if they're on because, you know, you sold me on the live experience.
You want to see? Honestly, I don't want to sound like that guy, but you want to see. You want to see him somewhere small. You do.
We are all that guy in this.
We are all that guy. Even Sian is that guy.
Sian is especially that guy.
Okay, let's have a bit more music from one of our guests. We always ask them to bring in a tune, and Anthony Teasdale, it's your turn today.
Surprisingly, I've gone for a slightly sophisticated, funky disco record.
How out of character!
Yeah. Karen O, she of the best haircut of 2002.
Yes.
Oh dear.
She's like a human play person, isn't
she? She's fantastic. I'm really into her. She's ace. She's done a track called Turn the Light, which is a joyous, lovely, pop, funky thing. And if it was a salad, it would be a Caesar salad. It'd be a delicious Caesar salad.
And apparently she's done it with Danger Mouse.
Has. Not Danger Mouse, who used to be with Penfold.
No, I think the listeners are probably up to date with that.
Who knows these days in the crazy meta world of pop?
Absolutely. So it's Caro and Danger Mouse, Turn the Light. Where is this from?
I've no idea where it's from. Okay. I just got it on Spotify. Look, I don't want to give away all my secrets here. But I follow loads of trendy people on Spotify and incredibly pretentious Balearic playlists. And it's from there. And I thought, I'll have that.
Here we go. Letting light in on magic there.
Okay.
Don't tell everyone.
Here's Karen O and Danger Mouse with Turn the Light. Okay, and on to The Virtues, Shane Meadows' gritty new Channel 4 drama starring Line of Duty's Stephen Graham as Joseph, a man who is indeed down on his luck. Meadows is known, of course, for Dead Man's Shoes, Once Upon a Time in the Midlands, and the This Is England film and TV trilogy, amongst others. He deals in the real stuff. So how does The Virtues compare? Well, there are a few tough nut teens and instead more middle-aged men. And do you need a box of tissues and a whole bottle of Schlur to get through it? We'll discuss after the trailer.
You all right there, fella?
I'm looking for Annie.
How do you know who I am?
It's me, it's Joseph.
You all right?
That's my brother.
Where's Silla Black when you want her?
Surprise, surprise.
Who's that?
That Joseph is my sister.
I think I know you, Joe.
I don't remember anything.
I swear to God, if I have to pull over now, I'll tell you.
Excuse the case, go on.
I get it. We were just dealing with stuff.
And that place leaves its mark.
Stop trying to get in my head, mate, because my head's not that good at the minute.
What have you done?
Something really bad.
Stop it!
Tell him what you want me to tell you. That's right.
The Virtues, Shane Meadows' new head-on four-part drama, co-written with Jack Thorne, who he usually writes with. In it, we see Joseph arrive for a last supper of sorts. His former partner, her new husband, and Joe's school-age son are all emigrating to Australia the next day. They eat and drink, and they have a very difficult, palpably tense meal. And that sets the scene for the first episode and the series. Michael Hann, how did you feel from the dinner party scene onwards, what that sets up and what we then go into with the Virtues?
Well, the first thing is that I'd never actually seen anything by Shane Meadows before.
Mm-hmm.
So this was my first Shane Meadows exposure.
Me neither. I'm a Shane Meadows virgin. Mm.
And I thought it was extraordinary. I didn't think it was terribly original. I mean, I think we've all seen those kind of things where someone goes on their journey into the heart of human desperation with a lot of walking around and a lot of handheld camera bits where things go a bit pear-shaped and where there isn't necessarily much dialogue. But it was so perfectly judged. The scene with his son, who mm-hmm. and the son's acting was extraordinary. It was so mm-hmm. naturalistic. It didn't seem like he was acting at all. Mm-hmm. It was absolutely brilliant. I found really, really heartbreaking, you know, the dinner and then going into the bedroom to give his son a cuddle. And, yeah, I was on the brink of needing to go and fetch the box of tissues there. And you find yourself thinking about your own relationship with your children. And, you know, I think, oh, because I've been really irritated with my son earlier that day. And I think, oh, God, I shouldn't have been like that. Or should I? Why didn't I just give him a hug? He might not be here anymore soon. And then to the scene in the pub, and there was this kind of grim inevitability. I mean, you're waiting to see yeah. when his wife says, are you okay? You think, okay, well, what's his problem?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
he goes to the pub and you discover what his problem is. Yeah. But the kind of way that the Stephen Graham is brilliant, the way he's kind of, you can sense the desperation of trying to find happiness, you know, I will find happiness by buying drinks for everyone in this pub. And it's, you know, it's all a facade. His entire night is a facade. You know the crash is coming. But again, the way they delivered the crash the next morning, you know, when he's lying on the rug in his flat covered in vomit, and again you're thinking, right, where do we go from here? Is it going to be, you know, hospital and rehab and everything? But no, he just gets himself up and then just has to get on with trying to go about his life. And I think it was so, so wonderfully judged in tone and everything. And Stephen Graham isn't portrayed as some kind of misbegotten saint or some terrible sinner. He's an ordinary man just trying to get by.
Mm-hmm.
I found him completely convincing. Although, I have to say, with the Stephen Graham Scouser going back to Ireland for some as yet undiscovered reason, there was a crossover in my mind with his character in Line of Duty.
Right.
The Scouser, who's actually come from Ireland in the first place. I did have my moment of confusion there, but that's not Shane Meadows' fault. He couldn't have known that Stephen Graham was going to be cast in two roles in
crossover
successive weeks.
Line of Duty Cinematic Universe.
Yes. It's postmodernism, isn't it? Mm. Anthony Teasdale, I believe you're from the Liverpool area of England.
As one can tell by my unusual brogue.
Does this reflect the atmosphere, the place? Is it something you recognise, along with the storyline, where it's set and the reason why it's set?
Well, I think the original, the first stuff is in, is that around the East Midlands?
It's Sheffield.
Is it Sheffield? Yeah. And I think,
sorry, my mistake then.
But the first 10 minutes, I just thought it was like, it's Shane Meadows tends to do East Midlands, Westerns. Have you ever seen Dead Man's Shoes? Absolutely fantastic. They're basically Clint Eastwood films set in depressing bits of Nottinghamshire. And I thought this was absolutely fantastic. I really like Stephen Graham. Sometimes I think he Stephen Graham's too much. When he becomes when you think he's going to explode, because there is a toughness to him.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, is he going to Stephen Grahamify this? The bit where he was in the pub, but he didn't. I thought he was absolutely fantastic as the dad who's, I mean, his son is going, so he's obviously devastated by this. And then very cleverly, these bits of sort of 80s VHS video coming, mm-hmm. are referencing some sort of weird religious cult, which I suspect is where he's going back to Northern Ireland to see. It's really, really good. There is also another highlight. I don't know if you spotted that at the ferry. That was really good because it was a bit of comic relief,
yeah,
and very much the epitome of the computer says no thing we've all had. An incredible bit of telly.
Yeah.
It's just really entertaining. It's like it's a really good Western. He's obviously going to find something. And I'm saying, pile in, kids. It's the thing.
I mean, he's you know, what I liked about it was that the entire first episode is pure setup. I mean, the show is clearly about repressed memories of some kind. Something terrible has happened to him in his past and it's made him into this guy. You know, he struck me as, you know, he's the guy sitting in the corner of every single pub you don't want to go in. He's been battered by life and also battered physically. Mm. You mentioned that, you know, Stephen Graham frequently explodes in his roles. That's not this character.
No,
this character
is
actually quite timid. And, you know, you kind of look at his sad attempts to buy affection in the pub and thinking, what has done it to, you know, what has done this to this guy?
Mm.
And I think I love the pace of it in that you don't get revelation after revelation in this first episode. You get a very slow burn. And I think over the four episodes, I hope it can maintain that very slow burn pace. Often in, you know, your television drama, as it has to compete, you know, in such a loud environment where everything's after your attention, you don't often get these islands of quietness and the story of a very, very ordinary bloke whose story yet is still, for him, the most important, the most epic thing that's happening in the world.
But what I thought about that is it's very cinematic, and you can see that Shane Meadows and Jack Thorne worked in films, because there's a lot of show and not telling. So there's a scene where he just goes into the park where he's bought the ticket and he's got 10 hours or 12 hours to wait before the ferry, and there's no dialogue. He's got a bottle of cider and it's whether he drinks cider or not. And there's no dialogue at all. All there is a kid playing in the corner in the park. It's really, really clever. And in that way, it takes, as I say, the noise out of it, because you're left to kind of pick up the jigsaw pieces and put everything together. And you know that something awful's happened, and it's the why, not the how. And all that sort of thing is really sophisticated storytelling, man. And I think that's why my mouth was agape at how good it is. But also, it's really structurally, it's really clean. There's nothing that you would have trimmed away.
Well, I've never thought this before watching any television programme, but I want to pay tribute to the ad schedulers for Channel 4. Because, you know, normally when you're watching a programme with commercial breaks, and even when they've thought carefully about where to put them, it destroys the flow. But this is written in such clean acts that each ad break actually comes at exactly the right place. I mean, obviously you'd rather it didn't have them at all, but it comes at the right place and doesn't destroy anything. And so each segment is completely separate and discreet, and there is no disruption to it. That's brilliant writing.
Yes,
it is.
Yes,
but the cinematography is fantastic as well, because the choreographing of his bender in the pub where he's buying strangers rounds and he's doing lines of coke with the landlord, and then it turns out that, you know, he actually can't cover the bill and all the rest of it. Is directed in a very distinct way from the very sort of slow and deliberate pacing of him on his own on the way to the ferry. And also the weird kind of Count Arthur Strong moment where he's actually, by the end of the bender evening, he's obviously incredibly pissed. And we see him staggering around at Sheffield City Centre. I don't know what the name of the camera is. That thing that they strap to the front of an individual and it just shows your face at the centre of frame no matter what you do. So the rest of the world pivots around you, but your face is always at the centre.
Yeah.
And he's kind of in dialogue with these memories that keep popping up, which clearly has a strong, you know, a strong element of religious terror in there. And it actually, you feel you have fallen into this well of drunkenness and fear with him.
Yes.
I just thought it's at a pure cinematography and directorial level. It's amazing and gripping and so much more compelling than the welter of spectacle we're surrounded with many shows at the moment, Game of Thrones, you know, where you just expected to fall prostrate before the explosion of a city by a dragon, which I do love, but sometimes things like this can be much more powerful.
Absolutely. It could have been really hammy as well.
Yeah.
Getting drunk is very difficult to act,
yeah.
and a room full of drunken people, and presumably they're filming that all day in the morning when no one's drunk at all. You know, this really difficult to do.
I got a strong impression that there's an awful lot of improvisation in this, because the naturalism of the chat with the kid in the bedroom, the naturalism of the pub scene, the naturalism of that park scene, where I think I'm sure the scripture says incredible. Stephen goes to park, do some acting. But Stephen Graham can do that.
Yeah. In that way, it reminded me of Mike Lee, Boys from the Back Stuff, Alan Bleasdale, all that sort of thing. Someone I saw likened it to Patrick Melrose from last year, which is about addiction, but about someone who is far more...
Posh addiction.
Posh addiction, this is
poor people addiction.
What I like about it is, so I am a big Shane Meadows fan. I like his understanding of his area. Yeah. And it is a part of the world, you know, that doesn't get a great deal of coverage, isn't it? You know,
Midlands,
yeah. Yeah, that part of that, especially that East Midlands, South Yorkshire thing. He understands it. All his films tend to be set around there. And if you haven't seen them, I would like A Room for Romeo Brass is fantastic. Dead Man's Shoes. Mm. They're set in the most unspectacular places, just really normal places. That no, you know, unless you have to go to that area, you don't have to. He's really great.
Mm-hmm. Can't binge on it, can you? Have to wait every week.
But I like
Channel 4. I know,
good.
I like
that's good.
That.
You know,
if I had a water cooler, I'd have a moment. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Wonderful. That's on the poster.
More having one now. Okay, let's get back to music and another choice from our guests. Michael Hann, it's your turn. What have you brought in for the show?
I really can't remember what it's called.
It's called Machi Basad
That's why we get the big books.
Okay, the reason I picked this track, whose title I couldn't remember until Andrew reminded me of it, is not because I like it. I don't like it at all. But it's emblematic of something I think is really fascinating. I was over in India earlier this year doing a piece for an in-flight magazine about Indian metal. One of the people I spoke to was a guy called Vernon, who was in the first ever Indian metal band called Millennium in the 80s. Now, he's a big proselytizer for Indian bands singing in their local languages. But metal in India is an almost exclusively middle-class thing. It's all sung in English. And he says that's one reason why hip-hop has exploded in India and metal hasn't. Metal is still this tiny, fragmented scene. There are a lot of bands, but, you know, they play to 200-300 people. They can only play 6 or 7 gigs a year because, actually, you can't bore everyone out by just going around the big cities. But Bloodywood released a song last year called Ari Ari, which was partly sung in Punjabi, kind of rap metal thing, based on a Punjabi folk song, and it blew up. By some distance, the biggest song ever in the history of Indian metal. You know, millions and millions and millions of YouTube views. A brilliant video film going around the streets, capturing everyday life. No one snarling, no one with feet on monitors, you know, none of that stuff. And I think they could be the future for how Indian metal can develop, you know, simply by doing this, by incorporating local elements. Now, there's another tension here, which is, you know, it's all very well for white people to say, you know, you come from an exotic country. Why can't you sing your exotic things rather than copying us? But, you know, Bloodywood are not aimed at me. They're aimed at kids in India, and it's working. However, there is a slight contrast between, you know, the millions and millions and millions and millions of YouTube views and how they're going over in the West. They're coming over for their first European shows this summer. I think their UK show, as far as I know, there's only one announced. It's at a pub in Milton Keynes. So there you go.
Well, I actually checked this out. It's the Rage Against the Machine tour. I'm really impressed by that. They sort of, like, thinking the way I think. I like these lads. There are some bigger venues. They're on a lot of metal festivals.
There are a lot of festival bills, yeah.
But I ran this past my wife, who does like heavy metal, and she really dug it. She thought this is quality stuff. She was thrilled by it.
Well, tell her to listen to Ari Ari, which I think is much better than this. But I think they're a really fascinating group.
Okay, well, this is Bloodywood, and the track is called Machi Basad, and I'm definitely pronouncing it wrong there, aren't I? Finally, Flying Lotus, a.k.a. Stephen Ellison, is a man with pedigree. DJ, co-producer of Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, electronic explorer and great-nephew of Alice Coltrane. But he's also on dependable Sheffield-born clonk label Warp Records, home of LFO and Autica and Aphex and Birds of Canada and all that kind of stuff, so you can sort of see where he's coming from. Flamagra is his sixth album, and it features collaborations with Anderson .Paak, George Clinton, Little Dragon, David Lynch, Shabazz Palaces and Solange Knowles, amongst many, many others. Spoilers, it's a cosmic Afro-jazz electro freakout, but is it any good? We're going to find out after this track. This is Tekashi. Mangan Up Herbie Hancock Sounds of Flying Lotus with Takashi. Now, Michael Hann, I think you spent a bit of time with this record, haven't you? Is it? It takes a lot of time.
I've tried to get through it several times. I was meant to be reviewing it for The Guardian, and in the end, I had to go back to The Guardian and say, look, you've got to get someone else to review this, because this is just...
You're not going to handle on it.
I couldn't get a handle on it. You know when people on social media, and they're expressing their... their lack of understanding for something, they post that Alan Partridge shrugging gif. That is me with this record.
Just right.
Got no idea. It's also not very helpfully supplied to reviewers in a single unbroken stream with no track breaks, which is intensely annoying.
The listeners will play the tiniest violin they can find for you.
I know.
But immediately, you get sent free records early. Boo.
And there are about 429 tracks on it as well. So it's not actually easy to just take and go, oh, no, that's that. I couldn't get... That's how far I considered thought. It's prog rock. I mean, that's what it is. You know, it's a prog rock record.
I don't know about that. Let's see what the Balearic community think about it. Andy Teasdale, as a spokesman for the Balearic community, what did you think of Flamagra?
I listened to it for the third time this morning, and the link between my Bluetooth and my computer isn't very good. And I couldn't tell whether it was the Bluetooth that was going wrong or the record. Mm. Turns out both. Because it's very glitchy and you're like, something wrong with my stereo here. Mm. However, I think it has its merits. This is not to say that I think I'll listen to it an enormous amount, but it does have its merits. At times, it feels like I've got heart palpitations going, bum, 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 bum. And then it goes into a really great rap record on there.
Yeah.
And there is, I think it's a bit Sly and the Family Stone. It's a bit sort of early 70s Miles Davis. I know I sound terrible saying that, but it is. There's a lot of soul and disco references there, but they've been put through like a Breville toaster.
Yeah.
And it sounds a bit odd, and it's not straight, and it is very weird. But I think if you like that sort of music, and I do, then it is definitely worth a go.
What I liked about it was that, I mean, it's definitely prog. It's prog, soul, jazz, cosmic, Sun Ra, orchestra, throw the ball as far as you can, loads of wild keyboard runs, multiple strange textures. You go from a kind of a cosmic swoop of sort of just ambient pad type things into, as you say, a straight up hip hop record. I found that actually very persuasive because it felt to me like a big mad mixtape. It felt like a big mad tour d'horizon of the entire world of black music since about 1956, with emphasis on current twisty electronica, as if you can kind of take everything that's happened in the worlds of jazz and funk, and if you were to kind of cram it through a warp-shaped hole, you would come out with this.
Warp-shaped hole that removes almost all the melodies.
I'm not that bothered about melodies. I find them kind of a bit boring. I like textures and strangers.
Oh, texture too.
Textures, man. Texture. But also that, you know, when you went, it's just prog, really, isn't it? And I've always struggled with prog rock, because I find it dull and indulgent. But I should love it, because what it's about is going out there. And this record goes out there with the things I like, i.e. funk, groove, you know, a bit of rap, a little bit of electronic scrunkiness, rather than somebody showing their guitar chops.
I was deeply put off. Having listened to like 45 minutes of it three times, and got, oh God, I need a break, by looking up some reviews of it and seeing one by an admirer of Flying Lotus saying, yeah, it takes a lot of listens before this record starts to make sense. God, life isn't long enough.
The consensus amongst Flying Lotus people is that he doesn't seem to have like taken it on very far this time. It's just there's more of it, but it hasn't actually taken his corpus of work to a new place. Sean, what did you think of this?
There's a good bit in it, one of the hip hop bits.
Everyone's just
the rapper. Yeah, I can't tell because it's 107 minutes, so I can't tell which bit it is. Where he shouts out for Nesquik. And I thought, yes, I like this one. It's difficult. And I did think, yes, you've got to listen to this 20 or 30 times. And that's not an exaggeration to then get it. It's a really slow burn. I think someone mentioned that phrase. It's difficult. It's complicated. And yet, intellectually, I think that's amazing. Yeah, difficult. Yeah. Come on, bring it on. And yet, it's who does have the time to do that. It's really, really hard to listen to because there's so much going on. There's no edit to it. I quite like it. I quite like Thundercat and Thundercat's on it. And the Thundercat thing is really good because the melodies in Thundercat are always rather strange. So I realised I had an in. So that was plus the Nesquik. So there were two things I could sort of get a hook onto. But yes, it's incredibly hard to hook onto it. Unless you know that stuff back to front, which you generally don't, because we don't live in California and we're not in their kind of clique.
Well, I don't know. I found it for odd, abstruse, rambling music. I actually found it very easy to sink into because, for me, the entrance point is it's Outkast. It's like this is basically an Outkast record turned up to 12 with the kind of melodies kind of removed and extra psychedelia. That's a pretty tasty proposition to me. I also like the fact that the collaborations are kind of seeded in there, but there's no kind of, and ladies and gentlemen, you know, here's Shabazz Palaces. They just bubble up and then they disappear.
Well, in that sense, it's absolutely anti-pop music, but I would say that Outkast are pop music.
Yeah.
There are no hooks. There's no kind of melodies. They're really, really hard, as I say, to find your way in. But I think probably when you find your way in, you're in and you can't escape.
Yeah. I mean, there's... That mixtape feel is compounded by the fact that in the middle, David Lynch pops up and just tells a crazy old man story.
Yeah, that was slightly irritating, I found.
But I'm just like, it's on a Ken Nordine feel. You're there for the texture of the voice.
Are you smoking pot again?
Well, as a non-pot smoking person, this made me feel, possibly this is what I imagine smoking the illegal drug marijuana feels like.
It's a lot worse than that.
So, I can't believe you're all standing up against difficult music.
No, I'm
come
not
on,
against it. I've picked it up before you. I'm in here.
It's difficult, though. It's going to take me two more weeks to decide whether I can do this or not.
I mean, that's why I said to the guy, I can't review this. I haven't got the time, as somebody who's coming to this from a position of unfamiliarity, to actually give you any reasonable, considered thoughts about it.
Well, I suppose what I liked about it was the mystery, because like most music, I know a lot about it. I know where it's coming from. I can see the foundations. It's all like the Pompidou Centre. You can see all the bits on the outside. And this, it's like, I've got a bloody clue what's going on here. Mm. And that's nice. That's a nice change.
Did you listen to it on your posh speakers? Is that the difference?
I actually listened to it on the Mac. I just listened to it on Mac speakers. Mm. And it was pretty persuasive.
There's a lot of stereo going on.
There's an awful lot of stereo. I have to keep moving my head around. Will it fit the Blair Rick bill? Could you basically slip this on and pretend you're mixing it all?
No, everyone would leave. There's just not enough Blair Rick guitar. There's no acoustic guitar. And there's no really chilled out Rhodes on there. It's difficult. I don't know if we all want that much difficulty in our life. I would like separate tracks because I can take off the hip-hop ones I do like on there.
I think you actually do get separate tracks.
On the actual release, it's just in the way it's been supplied to people before release.
They want to experience it as a whole is what they want you to do. I was surprised because I actually could not get my head around To Pimp a Butterfly, which is an enormous hit and considered to be one of the great statements of the moment. I just couldn't find a way in. And I actually found this more accessible and more, more persuasive. And I was surprised by how much I liked it because I was all ready to go, what is this random load of old nonsense? But actually, the randomness proved to be the thing. So anyway, I like it. You lot are all a bit...
No, I quite like it.
I quite like it.
I like it quite a lot.
I didn't say it was bad. I just said, don't understand.
Never mind.
He's probably a genius. He's probably Lotus a genius. Guy. He's probably a genius.
Probably a genius.
Yeah.
So we're coming to the end of the show, which means closing time chatter. What will our guests be discussing with Amel and the Sniffers on the porch in Mullumbimby over a couple of tinnies and a face full of liquid gold? Anthony Teasdale, what's your closing time chatter?
Football fans on Twitter.
All right. And why would that be?
Because they're terrible people.
Has there been a particular thing that's occasioned this opinion
it's
lately?
I mean, I shouldn't go on Twitter because, you know, I don't want high blood pressure.
Yeah.
But I do, especially around football. And if you think, you know, intra-Labour Party politics is poisonous, wait till you find football on Twitter.
Yeah.
Because it's like, is it the Red Wedding off Game of Thrones? It's like that. It's horrendous.
Yeah.
And people are either really offensive or offended, and it's usually the same thing. You know, I understand the passion of it and that it represents your city or something that you are really involved in. But stop getting offended. You know, it's the constant magnification of ordinary sort of...
But don't you think that that's actually not to do with football? That's Twitter. That's social media. Because football used to be a place where you could go and scream something absolutely indefensible into the air in the sure knowledge that nobody was listening and there'd be no comeback at all. And now, social media, people think they can come up with the same rubbish they used to yell on terraces. And the people they yell at can read and reply and actually pile onto them. And it's the same with football, politics. Probably Delia Smith cookery Twitter is probably just as bad. I can't believe he cracked the egg that way.
Yeah.
that is social media.
It just brings up the worst qualities in human nature and football. And I think you're probably right, it's politics as well. It just like magnifies it by 10.
That's Twitter for you, I think. That's Twitter.
Are you on Twitter?
Only periodically. I mean, we do the Romaniacs Twitter, which is obviously quite combative. and Big Mouth, we just tweet things, hey, this is interesting, and here's the show. Yeah. But on Romaniacs, we, you know, just the power of mute. Just like, you know, if somebody's horrible and you block them, they think they've achieved something. If somebody's horrible, or we have a lot of them on Romaniacs who are clearly, you know, sort of pro-am, political activists who are just trying to, you know, there's one or two people who anything we say on Romaniacs, they'll pile in with a counterpoint that's, you know, clearly just agenda driven. And you just mute them because what's the point? There's no point arguing with them. And what's the point giving them the satisfaction of knowing that you've blocked them?
So is that the key then, the mute?
Well, as my nan's wise advice, I'm not even going to ignore that. That was very powerful.
Nice.
Michael Hahn, what's your closing time chatter?
Next week, season 15, Deadliest Catch.
Okay.
The reality show that I love. It's about crab fishermen on the Bering Sea. And like the fall, it's always different, always the same. Really, only one thing happens in every episode. There are crab fishermen out in the sea. Some of them catch crab and are happy, and some of them don't catch crab and are unhappy. But it's the extremity of it all. The crab fleet tends to attract people of peculiar personalities, a lot of addiction problems there, people running from things, people who are incapable of any kind of social interaction.
Stephen Graham from The Virtues has been turned up on a crab boat.
Stephen Graham from The Virtues would be a crab fisherman, there's no doubt about it. But the extremity isn't just in kind of the people who go there, it's in the things that happen. And clearly there's an immense bond between the people who are filming it and the people who are making it. Annoyance at the camera people is real. And because they're on these boats all the time and have been for years and years and years, you know, they're completely open in front of the camera. So there'll be ongoing storylines like one crab fisherman whose son worked on his boat and the captain, just appalling bully. And if you're watching it, you could see that. But the captain didn't know he was a bully. He thought he was doing the best by his son. And in the end, the son walked off the boat and went to another boat. And this tension between them has been a big thing. One of the other big storylines at the moment is a young captain whose dad died 5 or 6 years ago. We saw the dad die.
Wow.
You know, I mean, it's...
Did a crab get him?
No, he died of a heart attack. Oh. A lot of these people have heart attacks because they sit, you know, they sleep for 2 hours a day and they sit on the bridge of their ship chain-smoking and drinking coffee. They all have heart attacks. People die when boats go down. You know, it's real. It's kind of horrifying. It's rarely euphoric, but I've come to actually really like a lot of these people on this programme over the years. It is a soap. It is a soap. But it's a soap taken to the kind of the extremes of the human condition. I recommend it to anyone all the time.
Is it National Geographic or something like that?
Discovery Channel.
Discovery Channel.
Does it make you eat more or less crab?
It makes me think that there's absolutely no way in the world I would ever go and be a crab fisherman.
Okay.
Good advice. Sure, what's your closing time chatter? Beat that. Don't be a crab fisherman.
Well, mine is very different. When I was 16, with my friend, I did a fanzine. There were lots of fanzines at the time about what they called shambling bands, which was the Sarah Records type. And we decided to do something different. It was about people on TV. So we wrote to people with a pen and a paper, kids, and wrote to their management and used to write lots of questions to get big, big space for the answers, do it in handwriting because they wouldn't reply if you'd done it sort of on computer. And we'd get a third of them back. And I was just looking over these fanzines because I am going to digitise them and put them out there because I realised we had these fabulous people in the fanzines. The first issue one, which is the central heating issue, by the way, because every one of them had a theme. It's called How to Win Friends and Influence People. Had Jim Bowen, Victoria Wood, Stephen Fry, Nicholas Parsons, John Peel, Bob Holness from That's My Dog fame. Bob Holness. Now I've got confused. There's another That's My Dog. He's in issue two. Christopher Lillicrap. And we actually, these are real
it's
interviews.
It's a galaxy of stars, actually. Yes. That's pretty good.
I realise.
It's the most consumer magazine.
Interview magazine.
Yeah. So Celebrity Cookery Corner, Victoria Wood sent us her avocado sandwich recipe, plus there's an interview. Alan Bennett, he had an interview that was, as I say, it's postal. How do you spend your leisure hours, we asked. I don't think like this, he replied, in capitals. And then at the end, most of his answers are no. He says, sorry to be such a disappointment, in capitals. You should have chosen someone else old. Cliff Richards, perhaps. and yeah, so Derek Hobson was the other Derek from That's My Dog. And it's just, I was reading through and I thought, this is a treasure trove of people we managed to get. Christopher Lillicrap, just the last one, because he was a children's TV entertainer at the time. There's lots of gherkins as well that my friend Nikki, I did it with my friend Nikki, that she's drawn. Do you feel you're a boy in an adult's body? No. What an interview there. So I'm digitizing that because they are actually quite funny. And props to Nikki because most of the really good jokes are hers. I'm going to sell them online because it's just like fanzines now. Like it's the same as it was in the
80s. Well, it's actually, you're mining the culture there. Well, we will let the listeners know when they can get this and they can find out about.
Yeah.
Victoria Wood, very ahead of the game with the smashed Avo there, I think.
Mm. Oh, yes, she was, wasn't she? There you go.
My closing time chat is a very quick one. I was listening to Radio 4 today, the other day. But like I continue to do, like a masochist. And Game of Thrones was on, and they had this little soundbite woman in their package. She said, Game of Thrones is really about the way we live today. And I thought, no, bloody isn't. It absolutely bloody isn't. It's not about our world today at all. It's the opposite. It's a medieval kind of quasi-mythical reimagining of the Wars of the Roses. It is about things like tyranny and lust for power and familial dynastic madness and cruelty and things that are eternal. So in that sense, it's about our world today, just as it would have been at our world 500 years ago or 1,000 years in the future. But it's not in the age of Trump. It's not in the age of Brexit. It's not in the age of our world today now, post-capitalism.
It's not Me Too.
It's absolutely not Me Too.
Yeah, but it's the cultural critic's way of asserting that something that they like needs to be paid attention to, isn't
exactly.
it? Just saying, it's about the way we live today.
Exactly. And it really annoyed me, the idea that absolutely everything has to be about the way we live now. We did a Romaniacs live event last night with Dorian Lynskey's new book, Ministry of Truth, which is about Orwell's 1984 as part of the show. And he pointed out that 1984 really is about the way we live now, because it's always been about the way we, from 1949 when it was written right up to now, it's always relevant. So it's not chiming with today's themes. Today's themes are chiming with 1984. You know, good sort of good fiction is applicable to the modern day, but it doesn't just apply itself to the modern day unless it's very clearly and overtly a satire or an allegory about current events. But to me, it's the need for these things to be conscripted into our modern concerns. You know, everything's got to be about the age of Trump, just as people would have said in the 1980s. Well, you know, it's an allegory about nuclear weapons, isn't it? Maybe it's just about dragons. Who knows? Who knows?
That's why they're critics, though, isn't it? Because they can't say what it's about because no one had paid them to say that.
That said, Andrew, I used to think that the Bayeux Tapestry was just about 1066 until I went down to Hastings and someone shot me in the eye with a bow and arrow.
There you go. History will do that to you. And that's the end of the show. Anthony Teasdale and Michael Hann are going to be sticking around for the extra bit in a minute. But what for the general listenership, what exciting project have you got coming up? After going to see Sting and Shaggy, what's up next?
Well, I'm going to the Sea Change Festival in Totnes in Devon on Friday. Laura Barton and I are going to be doing some, as yet, unspecified in conversation about Bruce Springsteen.
Oh, right.
No idea what either of us are going to say, and there's no one to interview us. We're just going to make it up as we go along.
You just say, Bruce, yeah, great. How about you, Anthony Teasdale? What's your next things on your agenda?
I've got to finish Quintessentially magazine, which is the magazine I edit for a nice Quintessentially concierge service. I've got to do that. Includes interviewing lots of people, but people nowhere near as good as the people who
are. Victoria Wood. She's hard to get now. Yes.
Hey.
And basically, I'm having these little moments of panic now before the big football match.
All right, don't worry. It'll be fine. It's going to be good. Patreon people, the extra bit will be with you soon. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Sean and to producer Elsie Bath. Thanks again to Tom Bullen of Air Edel Studios in London for bailing us out studio-wise. Mm. We're going to play out with a reminder that I am playing an all-new order set.
Are you?
Yes.
Have I
mentioned that?
Yeah, when?
At London's King's Cross Spirit Lands.
I've played Spirit Land, Andrew. Even me.
Just reminding the listeners, Thursday, 6th of June, all-new order all night. New order are famously promiscuous on the remix front. Sometimes they're great, often they're terrible, but this is one of the great ones from 2002. Glory days of Electro Clash. This is the Coma and Bones mix of confusion. Imagine this on speakers the size of your shed. We'll see you next week. Bye. Sharing and hoping and such for so long. I've lost the change from the
nothing. I think you should know.